ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
There used to be two truths about Australia. One was that for most Australians, life was getting better. It was becoming easier to get the things we wanted. The other was an unspoken compact that each generation would be better off than the one before it. Neither seems to be the case anymore, unless you're well off, or your family is well off, because it bought a home when homes were affordable. How did homes, of all things, suddenly become so out of reach in a country with enviable amounts of land that once boasted one of the highest rates of home ownership on earth? Is this the sort of Australia we'd choose if we could choose our own Australia? And how on earth did we get here? Welcome to Choose Your Own Australia on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and someone who was onto some of these changes early as an economist and interest rate strategist at Macquarie and Westpac, from which he's just retired, Rory Robertson, and ABC News business editor Michael Yander, who last year produced a five-part series about the housing crisis for ABC News Daily called Housing Hostages. Welcome, Rory. Welcome back, Michael.
Hi, everyone. G'day.
Rory, is housing weird? By that I mean, is it what economists call a superior good, one about which we're never satisfied? An inferior good is one we demand less of as our income climbs. Powdered milk is said to be one of those. Cars are said to be a normal good. We spend about the same proportion of our income on cars, even as our income climbs. But housing, we seem to spend more and more of our income on it the more income we've got, almost any free money we've got.
I think that's one way of describing it. The other way of describing it is that housing is a unique product in that people don't try to find the cheapest house they can afford. They try and find the most expensive house they can afford.
Why?
Because it's there's this never satisfying trade-off between size of the house and land and proximity. So people tend to want the best combination of proximity and size that they can afford. So, you know, in Australia at least, people devote their entire financial resources to getting the best house they can afford, and that's some combination of size and proximity. And if you're really wealthy, you can have a big house overlooking Sydney Harbour, and if you're not, you can't, and you have to basically retreat to
two streets back.
Well, smaller size, or to 50 or 100 kilometres back. But, you know, this never satisfying trade-off between size and proximity is a feature of the Australian property market.
And let's face it, there's a finite supply of well-located land, that there are only so many harbour views in Sydney.
So when people talk about supply, they say more supply, build more houses. It'd be a good thing to do, but that won't increase the supply of those houses that people will put all of their final dollars into, those that are near the water or near the CBD.
What you find is a standard result across the globe, across the Western economies at least, is that the cities that are coastal and sort of global in inverted commas and where wealthy people want to live, those superstar-type cities are the most expensive in terms of price to household income. That's just a standard result. So if you want an expensive house, that's where you find where wealthy people want to live, because all the wealthiest people are competing for the best bits of ground. In Australia, pretty well everyone has ever made big dollars in Australia, from the wool boom to the gold rushes to the, you know, what a financial deregulation to AI booms right now. Like, first thing most of those individuals do is buy the biggest house they can find in the state capital where they made their money. It's almost a standard result.
And it's why just building more apartments doesn't do anything to solve the house price problem. If you look at Sydney, apartment prices haven't risen anywhere near as far as house prices have appreciated, precisely because you can build more and more apartments, but if people have the money, they still want the house. And as you build more apartments, you actually have fewer houses because you're demolishing the houses to build the apartments. So they actually supercharge house prices and force more people, more average income people, into apartments.
Can you tell us, Rory, about a specific decision made just ahead of the year 2000 that you started sending out those emails to clients? What was the specific decision that probably helped ignite the explosion in home prices?
Well, it was one of the factors. As I said, the halving interest rates and the boom in migration have probably been the biggest things. But the halving of the capital gains tax, that I think really enlivened the investors' desire to gear up into residential property in particular.
Well, you helped do it. You wrote a letter to clients saying, quote, "Since September 1999, that's when the headline rate of capital gains tax was halved. Before that, there was just an adjustment for inflation. Since September 1999, quote, it is almost as though the Australian tax system has been screaming at taxpayers to gear up and earn increased capital gains rather than to work harder to earn increased wages or salaries." Michael, that's what an awful lot of Australians did, geared up to earn increased capital gains. Before 2000, before that halving in the headline rate of capital gains tax, Australia had 1.3 million landlords. By 2020, we're close to 2.3. That's the best part of a million extra would-be investors at auctions, outbidding would-be first-time owners, keeping them as renters. Is this what people expected at the time?
Not necessarily. A lot of the push for the reduction in capital gains tax, or certainly the public justification, was around increasing investment in innovative businesses through equity. But as we found out, when it comes to investing, Australians just seem to have a strong affinity to putting it in bricks and mortar. And the other thing that makes logical sense is you don't usually borrow money to buy shares, right?
But there are firms that will do that for you.
There are.
It's not like every bank on every corner.
Exactly. And it's usually very high interest rates. It's also very risky. You can be subject to margin calls and, you know, have leverage that means you lose a lot more than you invested in the first place. But people do borrow money to buy houses. And that's where the capital gains tax cut started interacting with a long-standing tax policy, which is what we call negative gearing, which is the ability to write off losses that you incur to generate income. In this case, your mortgage payments and other expenses on a rental property offset against any rent you make. And when you can do that, because you've got this huge mortgage, and then you get a capital gain and you only pay tax on half of it, it starts looking pretty good to high-income people.
Was there also a feeling, Rory, and is this feeling continuing, that, you know, the saying, safe as houses, we don't say that about shares, that in some sense the government will guarantee that house prices won't fall?
Not quite guaranteed, but I think safe as houses is a thing. And we saw that in the GFC. And in fact, it was the basis for one of the bets I had that became quite high profile, where a fellow called Professor Stephen Keane ultimately walked from Canberra to the top of Mount Kosciuszko, because his story was everything's going to hell in the handbasket. Australian home prices on average are going to fall 40%. And he sold his apartment in Surry Hills. He thought there was great instability in household debt and debt in general. And he thought the whole system was going to fall over. But obviously the government and the Reserve Bank of Australia's job is to make sure the system doesn't fall over. And the first thing the Reserve Bank did in response to the developing global financial crisis was to cut interest rates by one percentage point. So the Reserve Bank cut by four percentage points towards zero and ultimately stabilised the system quite quickly. So Steve's story that house price would fall 40%, I said, if you're less than half right, you should walk from Canberra to the top of Mount Kosciuszko.
And he did.
And ultimately the prices fell 4 or 5%, reversed within a year, and he did walk. Good luck to him.
Supporting home prices seems to be one of the constants in Australia, at least in a crisis, something we need to bear in mind if we are to choose our own Australia, which is the title of this special summer series of The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and economist and interest rate strategist Rory Robertson and ABC business editor Michael Yander. Michael, what's this growing division of Australia into those born earlier who bought property when they could and those born later, many of whom can't imagine themselves buying it? What's it doing to our notion of Australia, a place in which we all have a stake?
Yeah, it's a great question, Peter. Just to give some numbers around that, when baby boomers were in the age of 30 to 34, around two-thirds of them already owned a home. You know, obviously, most of them with a loan. The same figure for millennials is now less than half. So less than half of 30 to 34-year-old millennials own their home, even with a mortgage. And that's a huge social shift. People are buying later, if they're buying at all. It has social effects. We've just recorded the lowest fertility rate in Australia on record, now down to 1.48 children per woman. The population would be shrinking if it wasn't for the migration levels we're seeing. The median age of mothers has gone up from less than 30 at the turn of the century in the year 2000 to more than 32. Same for fathers, up from 32 to about 34 years of age. So people are having families later, they're having less children, they're having smaller homes. It's really reshaping the social fabric in Australia. Now, there are other factors contributing to that as well, but there's no doubt that expensive housing and a trend towards the affordable housing being smaller apartments is contributing to the type of family formation. And ultimately, it's causing some big social shifts and arguably even some big political shifts. Because if you look at the history of Australian housing, we were a nation of majority renters up to the end of World War II. But bipartisan policy from both Labor and the Liberal Party was to increase home ownership dramatically after World War II. From the conservative side of politics, it's very interesting. Robert Menzies, the founder of the Liberal Party in Australia, really saw the benefit of giving people a stake in their own country. Turning us into little capitalists with a stake of ownership as a bulwark against communism. Because if you own a piece of the country, if you have an asset, then you don't want to be a communist who socializes all those assets. And you've got to think of that Cold War mentality. But what we're doing now is heading towards what we used to have, which is a nation of renters. And perhaps it's no surprise that the latest Australian election study from the 2025 election shows an utter collapse in support for the coalition and right of centre parties. Labor has a two-thirds two-party preferred vote amongst under 45s. In the past, when people were accumulating assets in their late 20s and their 30s and started owning a home, the tendency would be to go from being more radical in your teens and 20s when you didn't own anything to being more conservative once you do. But if people stop being able to get into the housing market and they don't have any assets or their debts are so large that even if they do, in inverted commas, own a home, they don't feel like it because they've got a huge 30-year mortgage, then it makes sense that people might be more likely to stay left of centre and be looking at redistribution rather than maintaining what they don't have.
Do you see that?
A lot of long bows there, I reckon. I think the idea that the Australian dream is unavailable is mostly nonsense. I think it's absolutely true that we have millions of people growing up in Sydney who won't be able to afford to buy in places where they grew up. They won't be able to buy in the same places that their parents bought in. But that's not the end of the Australian dream. That's basically the signal that people need to adjust their expectations. The sexy global coastal cities where wealthy people want to live are expensive. Like, that's just the reality of it, and it's a reality everywhere. When someone says, I can't buy in Sydney, you know, all I hear is, I can't buy in Paris. Like, yeah, I understand.
You can't buy in Paris.
But basically, there are a whole bunch of housing markets in Australia, and there's no reason why any particular person in Sydney who can't afford a place can't move somewhere else. And there are hundreds upon hundreds of lovely places in Australia that aren't Sydney where you literally can buy a house with 400, 800 square metres with a house on it, mostly better than the houses I lived in as a boy, for, you know, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, which is within reach of most Australians if they want to do that.
Although, as your contemporary Jared Minnack pointed out to me earlier this year, Adelaide houses are now more expensive than American houses at the peak of their housing bubble. Newcastle houses and houses in Wollongong are now where Sydney house prices were 5 years ago. So this scope of housing affordability really is shrinking rapidly, particularly since COVID, with that latest property boom that really has spread the unaffordability to Brisbane, to Perth again, to Adelaide, even Hobart at various points has become extremely unaffordable.
These cities, these coastal cities that dominate their region and the only place that wealthy people in the region want to live, and that's Hobart, like they're expensive, no doubt. But, you know, if you wanted to move from Sydney, I'd encourage people to go on a domestic holiday and go and visit Rockhampton or Townsville or Cairns or Mackay or Toowoomba or Armidale or Tamworth. And imagine, you know, go and look at the housing markets there and go, well, if I could convince a couple of my friends to move with me, we could have a very nice life here with our partners and our children, and we'd get away from the Sydney congestion. I think there's a lack of imagination. When I arrived in from Townsville in the late 80s, it struck me immediately that most people in Sydney could have much nicer lives in Townsville if they sold their house, bought a house for one third or one half the price in Townsville, and had the rest to live a nice life. Like they'd probably never have to work again at that stage.
That presupposes you've got the house in Sydney to sell, and a lot of boomers are doing that. We've seen huge outflows of people to particularly the more southern parts of Queensland as people cash out of a Sydney home. But the reality for working age people is, where is the employment? Where are the decent paying jobs? And aside from the mining sector and a few jobs here and there, most of the employment is still in Sydney, Melbourne, Perth.
So some of the move up in house prices is an indication of success. So basically, there's a whole world beating their path to our door to live here because of the way Australia's set up.
You know, we should be proud of what's happening.
Well, it is success.
Adelaide, which has overtaken Melbourne, Adelaide should take that as a sign of success. What Paul Keating, the former treasurer, used to call it, is talking about the Australian dollar, the national virility test. We should be proud that Sydney is one of, if not on some measures, the most expensive city in the world.
Well, I don't know about that, but a lot of the houses are getting purchased with wealth, not income. So, you know, the people starting out are behind the eight ball right away. And just in central Sydney, so whether it's Surry Hills or just near Central Station, you know, Atlassian and Canva are two firms that didn't exist a decade or two ago, are both got market capitalisation of 50, 100 million Australian dollars. Billion Australian. And you know, and that throws off massive housing demand. We've seen high-profile purchases by the principals of one of those firms where basically you need a $100 million property in Bellevue Hill, one each. You need something down the Southern Highlands. You need something in Palm Beach. And nothing wrong with that. But that's one of the features of Australia, is that the affluence is one of the things driving the capital city home prices. As I said earlier, anyone who's made big money in Australia, not only have they bought a house themselves, there's mum, there's cousins and sisters, and, you know, if people are affluent, there's a lot of housing demand gets thrown off from it.
Would we do, by the way, for young Australians who are not from wealthy families, who on the face of it have very little chance of buying, and you were one of them?
Well, I got lucky, and the main reason I got lucky
That was in the 1980s.
I got lucky because I got educated, and I think that is basically the history of the world, is that the main thing that drags kids of poor people out of poverty is education. So that's the single most important thing to help drag people out of poverty.
In our own way to do something about education here on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National. The title of the summer series is Choose Your Own Australia. Our guests are economists Rory Robertson and Michael Yander. Rory, choosing your own Australia makes it sound as if we can choose a future. Is there, given what you've described, any future you can see in which home prices come down, move back even toward where they used to be?
There would be a future, but it would be a bleak future. The main sort of example in the history of the modern world where houses suddenly became more affordable is the Rust Belt of America. Notably, number one in the latest list is Pittsburgh. You know, there's the name. But all these cities that basically were shining cities 50, 100, 200 years ago, and now they're not.
That's what it would take.
Shrinking populations, you know, collapse of the economies, that's what it would take. Basically a go-ahead economy in Australia all I see is rising house prices to income ratios. The main scope for people to have the houses they want in the yards they want is to decentralise, to get away from the big capitals.
To build a new city? Well, we did it once.
We did. The Canberra is sort of a clear example of where, you know, massive public subsidies for infrastructure can build you a nice, shiny city that is very pleasant to live in. I only lived in Canberra for a year, but it's a beautiful place to live and grow up in if that's where you get to. But there are hundreds, literally hundreds of very nice towns and small cities across Australia where people in the capital cities who don't want to rent their entire life can move to, and there are houses in many of these places for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, which, you know, if the median income's, you know, near $100,000 for full-time earners, there's scope for them to have a nice house with a nice yard without all the hustle, bustle, congestion of the city.
If we can get the jobs there.
If you can get the jobs, and that's what work from home allows now.
Although I assume technology makes it easier. Michael, you've found one city in Australia which actually is doing something to bring prices down with some success. It's Melbourne. What's it doing?
Look, a range of things. I mean, one thing is accidental, which is what Rory alluded to, which is since COVID, Melbourne has had a lot of economic struggles, and with the lockdowns there, its economy has not performed anywhere near as well as most of the other parts of Australia. But it has done a bunch of other things too, which have also contributed, because it's not the only place that has had some of those struggles. It has increased supply quite considerably, particularly both inner city apartments, a lot of high rise, but also developing on the fringes of Melbourne, which is a bit easier with the geography there. A lot of planning reforms similar to what is happening in Sydney now, belatedly to try and get more apartment construction going. It has also introduced new taxes on property, so particular taxes on landlords. And so we've seen the rate of first home buyers in Melbourne be the highest in the country amongst all the states. Only the ACT was rivaling it last year.
And the number of rentals have dropped.
And the number of rentals has dropped, which makes sense because when a rental
gets... Investors are selling to first home buyers.
Exactly. When a rental gets sold, if a landlord says, this tax means it doesn't make sense for me to keep renting this property out, well, they don't demolish that home, do they? They sell it. And if other landlords also think, well, it doesn't make sense for me to invest here, who buys the home? It's someone who wants to live in it.
They're also imposing a tax on vacant properties, which seems to me to be such an obvious idea. Who wants a vacant house?
Yeah, so there's obviously things like holiday homes, and some of those are caught up, although there are exemptions for holiday homes in the Victorian tax system. But it's not a huge percentage of the total housing stock, but it is up to about 1.5%. And if you could increase the housing stock within a couple of years by 1 or 1.5%, that would make a meaningful difference to prices.
Is there anything else you would do?
The number one thing I'd look at is stamp duty, because that's a massive upfront cost to buyers.
It makes it hard to downsize, for instance.
Makes it hard to save up a deposit and makes it hard to downsize. So we've basically built a tax system where all the incentives are holding on to what you've got and perhaps getting more, rather than adjusting your housing depending on your life stage or where you need to live. If you replace stamp duty with land tax, you'd actually be penalising the people who have big blocks of land but no kids to run around in the garden. And in return, you'd be removing the disincentive of stamp duty from them downsizing and buying somewhere else.
And one state in Australia, one territory, the ACT, is doing that. What would you do, Rory? I know you've said that there's little hope, but what...
No, well, I've said the opposite, actually. I've said there's plenty of hope if people open their
for
minds.
For individuals?
Well, starting with individuals, yeah. Like, there are hundreds of towns in Australia that's not in Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane or the other capitals where...
They're getting more expensive, but still.
Yeah, sure. But basically, as I said, there are... If you go to any real estate website, you can find properties that are $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 on blocks of land. They're not awesome in the sort of minds of the people who are looking at them, but they're better than many of the houses I lived in as a boy. And if you want to... Either you want your own house on your own bit of land or you don't. So you can't do it in Sydney. So the opportunities are elsewhere. I do like the idea of to lessen the problem somewhat. Bigger land taxes on second homes. I mean, affluent people, including me, have second homes because the beach or whatever, the Gulf. So that's a thing, and it's a growing thing because there's growing affluence in Australia. As I said, the wealth that has been saved and kept in Australia has been recycled into the biggest house people can afford in the city and often a house somewhere else that's nice to go to in the holidays, all that. And so that limits the opportunities for young people.
And, I mean, you were talking about a lot of the wealth that's been imported through migration into Australia and put into property. A land tax, a broad land tax on all property, would capture some of that wealth. And if you use the revenue from that land tax to actually lower taxes on, say, income or genuine investment in research and development and productive enterprise, we might actually shift some of the hoarding of property. And
Michael, I think you just lost the election.
That's my final question. This is Choose Your Own Australia. My final question is, we'll start with you, Rory. Do you think we as a nation actually seriously want more affordable homes?
No. I mean, we want it, but not to the exclusion of anything else that matters. You know, there are a lot of crocodile tears cried for first home buyers. Meanwhile, we have this big Australia immigration policy, and the federal government can talk all it likes about, you know, the poor first home buyers, but the policies don't support the first home buyers. In fact, they actively disrupt the first home buyers.
Michael, do you think we genuinely want more affordable homes?
Of course not. I completely agree with Rory there in terms of the leadership of the country. And this is where it's getting back to the politics, Peter. The more and more people who are stuck renting, the more and more the pressure will grow to tax landowners, people who do have a home. But as I said, still about two-thirds of people do own a home. And so the political pressure isn't there yet. And it will take decades to build. If we follow the current trends, it will probably be 30, 40, 50 years until we get back to having 50-50 renters and homeowners. When we get to that point, maybe there will be genuine pressure for change. But as it stands now, all the policies that purport to help first home buyers are generally ones that just give them more capacity to borrow or some grants that will push up demand and end up meaning they pay more for the home they buy anyway. So they're not really helping the buyer, they're helping the people who already own the homes.
In preparing for this interview, I went back to something I wrote when I was at Macquarie. I started writing when after my first son was born and I suddenly learned to get up before 5 a.m. I got up at 2 a.m. sometimes and I wrote this 40-pager and I sort of published it through Macquarie in end of 2006. And the punchline after the 40 pages was basically, if Australia continues to be a prosperous nation with, you know, strong demand from others to come here and a big immigration policy, the ratio of home prices to income in our cities would continue to rise. It's just a side effect of an affluent economy where in Australia, with this giant wide brown land, but barely anyone wants to live in the wide brown land. They all want to live in the six coastal capitals that dominate their states. And that's where the wealthy people are. And that's where most other people want to live. And so there's just this ongoing steep competition for these finite numbers of well-located homes. And the only solution that actually assists anyone is really making sure that there are lots of apartment buildings for people who do want to live in Sydney who can't afford any of the blocks that the affluent people have already got.
Rory Robertson, housing watcher for decades now, as we've established, as an economist and interest rate strategist at Westpac and Macquarie Bank, and ABC business editor Michael Yander, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
And thank you for listening. This is our special summer season of The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National. It's called Choose Your Own Australia. You can find the other parts right now on the ABC Listen app. If you've any thoughts or questions or comments about the series, I think you well might. No economic question is stupid. You can email us at theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.